Escape from Plan A.
Escape. Escape. Escape.
From Plan A.
Okay, welcome to Escape from Plan A. This is the host of Plan A team, but this might be a crossover episode, so I guess maybe I should also let T intro as well.
Yeah, why not? This is T from Champagne Sharks. How's it going? Trevor Beaulieu. And yeah, we should probably call me Trevor throughout the show so it doesn't cause a confusion with Teen. But yeah.
Oh, yeah, we've had that issue
before. It's been a
common
problem, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, it's been this topic I thought was a pretty interesting one, and I think it's especially relevant to an article that came out this week, but I'm sure we can come up with other examples. But it was Chris's idea for this topic, right?
I think it was Teen's, but hey, I'll take credit.
Yeah, I mean, I can just give the way I teed it up, and I'm sure that we'll get a little bit more specific about it, but you know, like it's no secret. Like when we did our podcast, Escape from Plan A, like it was really influenced by Champagne Sharks because we, Chris and I both had listened to it a lot. And one thing we noticed was, I mean, because I think Champagne Sharks, you all took a slightly different approach to talking about race in particular that had a certain like kind of class element to it. Or I don't know about class element, but like understanding that there were factions within like what you would call Black America, and sort of like it was almost like a taxonomy of the different factions and the blue checks and stuff. And one thing that Chris and I had really marveled at was how a lot of the patterns that were being described on your pod really mirrored this almost like one-to-one what was going on with Asian people in America, right? And this whole like disdain towards the blue checks and the competing narratives, I think, about, you know, this whole like sort of elite media class always sort of kicking out really similar sorts of stories and narratives and a desire to assimilate, and but also a certain performative victimhood or something like that. And it just seemed, one, that there was a lot of similarity. And then the other thing which prompted me to say maybe I'd love to talk to you and Chris about this because you two seem to be really observant about this. I think actually what's happened is that over time, a lot of the stuff that was usually associated with Asian Americans, like model minority and wanting to be like media representation, wanting to be seen and dealing with assimilation into white people, it seemed to have flipped where I feel like a lot of the discussions I see on Black Twitter and things like that sound a lot like the Asian model minority discourse that we used to have and we thought was totally unique to us. And at the same time, now Asian Americans are starting to talk a lot in a way that reminds me of like earlier Black movements about, you know, Asian community self-defense and the Asian relationships with police and with government and things like that, because, you know, obviously we're in the kind of COVID period. So that was the
even
sort of
like even like a Back to Asia movement that's kind of stirring about.
Yes. Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Pan-Asianism. That's another big topic right now. Pan-Asianism.
Oh, wow.
And all that. And it's really in a thing where what I've seen online, especially with the rise in sort of like anti-Asian violence and stuff, that has like really overtaken the point where it's crap. I don't know. I mean, maybe my feed or my view on social media is kind of one-sided, but I feel like that has really changed the conversation where the Asian Americans at large are really rejecting a lot of the assimilationist stuff. Like, for example, like the backlash against Andrew Yang when he did an op-ed about how to like avoid being attacked by, you know, wearing UCLA gear or joining the army. There was an immediate backlash by Asian Americans in the mainstream. So I think this is really happening. And at the same time, a lot of the stuff I see about Netflix shows and woke culture and stuff, it felt it feels very like what Asians had moved away from. So I'm wondering if there's some sort of like inversion here of who is the model minority and who, you know, like who occupies that space. Is there some sort of something going on?
I mean, it's pretty interesting to me that a lot of this is kind of weird convergence that's going on, even within the blue check sphere, where the Asian blue checks and the black blue checks seem to be taking a lot of cues from each other. And what I mean by that is, like, just a lot of that kind of faux woke language, I've seen them like kind of sharing. And I was telling someone the other day that I feel like blue checks are more like each other than they are like any other group. Like,
with their own group, right?
Yeah, they're their own group. A blue check black person, a blue check Asian person, a blue check Latino, a blue check white person have more in common with each other than that white person has with other white people, that Asian person has with other Asian people. Like I think in addition to what you're saying about Asian American discourse and black American discourse kind of swapping, I think, you know, among like, you know, the regular people on the ground, I think on top of that, there's this kind of weird hive mind class forming where the blue checks are on their own weird thing altogether. And I feel like there's something else that I've started calling wanna checks, like people who technically aren't blue checks, but they write like they're auditioning to be one. Like they tweet, like they go to the mattresses for the same stupid things and tweet in the same sassy way, but the person is not, and they cape for blue checks. If a blue check is being attacked, they'll jump in and say the same things. And you're like, is this person a reporter? Then you look and the person is just someone who works in an office or something. You know, it's like, I feel like people are hoping to become a blue check one day if they tweet hard enough. And
yeah, it's a mindset. It's a lifestyle.
It's very much a mindset for sure. I want to ask you, did one of you guys ever like write to my curious cat or something for the short time I had a curious cat and mention Frank Chin? Because I remember one time when I first started the pod, someone said, hey, have you ever read Frank Chin? I think you would like him. And when I read Frank Chin, I had a similar experience to what Teen talked about, where I was like, oh, wow, I can't believe this sounds exactly like when Frank Chin was talking about, you know, it was that essay, Come All Ye.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, not that one. Come All Ye Asian American Writers, I think it's called.
Yeah, the
one
of the real and fake, right?
Yeah, the real and fake. And that one, I was like, holy crap. And that one's been like very influential on me. But yeah, I was like, oh, my God, everything he's talking about, you know, about women of color being elevated over men of color writers and being rewarded for spreading these patriarchal narratives about, you know, the men of color and kind of making white men seem like, you know, these kind of enlightened saviors. And I was like, wow, this is exactly the same thing, but from like decades ago.
Right. I think you mentioned that before. So when you say that, because Frank Chin probably wrote that in like the 60s or 70s, right?
Yeah, totally.
And you're reading it in the late 2010s.
2018.
2018,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you're saying that you also felt that there was this sort of like swap in the sense that this was something fairly new among like the way, like what was going on with black people online? Or was this something you're saying, oh, this was a longstanding pattern, I just didn't know that this applied to Asian people or an Asian person would have been cognizant of this?
A little bit of both. Like, I think it was a longstanding pattern. Like, I think Color Purple with Steven Spielberg and, you know, Alice Walker, and even Alice Walker thought that the movie went too far. You know, kind of had this thing where all the black guys are brutes and, you know, all this stuff. But so I didn't think it was new, but it was newer than the Asian version for sure. Like the Color Purple was like kind of like a test run. And I felt like now it's kind of hit an established pattern where it almost runs on its own. They don't really have to do much except just not get in the way of it. It's kind of automatic now, kind of. Whereas before, I think it was a very conscious new thing around the time of Color Purple. So I felt like it being a well-oiled machine was new, but the concept of the test drives of it was old. But when I read the Frank Chin essay, I was like, okay, for on the Asian side, the well-oiled machine is old. Like it was a well-oiled machine in the 60s. Like, he had multiple examples. He had, like, all the stuff that I kind of see is all the features of this kind of white male savior. And people talk about white savior, but I feel like there's a white male savior subgenre of the white savior. And I was like, wow, all the tropes, everything that, you know, I thought I was putting together now, like, he has them all and then some.
Yeah, if there is any inversion happening, I think it's because for Asian Americans, it's been so established. This is the default. I think ever since probably 1965, this has been the default Asian American culture, to the point where everyone's just like fucking sick of it and everyone knows upon it on site. But I think for a lot of Black Americans, this seems very new, and it probably was what Asian Americans felt like maybe in like the 70s. This is something radical. This is something... like, and I think this is perfectly exemplified in the whole Meghan Markle thing, which is just the absolute perfect manifestation of that like white savior ideal. Like, it's a woman of color crashes this old white institution, and through her like superior beauty and charm and intelligence and wit and all that, upstages everybody, especially the white women, makes off with the white prince, and that is how justice is formed. And I think that is it's such a, you could not be more like hit all the perfect notes. And I think that's why it strikes a chord with a lot of people, because you can't really get any purer than that.
Yeah, for sure. You know, one thing that's kind of interesting, I was talking with you guys before it started about all these weird things being done about passing, and they're green lighting anything that has to do with passing. They have passing storylines in Lovecraft Country and other things, with passing being about Black people being able to pass as white. And what I find interesting, I mean, there's a novel that by this new blue check of the moment, they've been grooming her for a while, Britt Bennett, and she's got like a 7-figure.
Oh, yeah. What's that book called? The Vanishing Half or something?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that got a 7-figure deal from Netflix. Jeremy O'Harris from Slave Play is going to be writing the series on HBO, because he got an all around deal with HBO too. So he's going to write that. And I think Issa Rae is producing. It's just so incestuous and weird.
It's the all-star team.
Yeah, it's the all-star blue check team. And what was interesting, I was like, why are so many people writing about it? And they're all unambiguously Black people. Like, they're like 100% dark skin. Like, why is this such an interesting topic and anxiety for them? And I kind of realized, like, it's the purest physical manifestation, the physical actualization of their psychological struggle, which is that I think these people want to culturally pass. Like, they want to culturally assimilate. Like, it's the purest physical representation of, I think, a struggle that they have. They know they can't physically pass, but there's this kind of idea that psychologically, culturally, if I can culturally master so-called whiteness enough, I can culturally be indistinguishable from you, to the point that I can hang out with you guys or intermarry with you guys or live with you guys without having to have the differences always thrown in my face, or that I can talk to you and be with you for a while and people can actually forget I'm Black. It's like the same way the physically passing person, you know, people can either not know or forget, you know, that the person is black. So I think that's kind of the sick manifestation. The accession, I think it's like a literal manifestation of this. And I think also the idea of if the literally white looking person who's black can't pass, then what does that mean for me who's just trying to culturally pass? I don't even have the physical. So I think that's the end, because these people have no intellectual curiosity about anything. So anything they're interested in has to have some kind of narcissistic navel gazing angle to me, of something that they're trying to work out, because that's the only way they engage with anything, either as a creator or a consumer.
Yeah, either that, or I think they think it's demographic destiny for their community. Maybe not for themselves. True. Maybe they actually, you know, have black partners, but they think that eventually either their kids or their grandkids are going to like intermarry with white people or any other like light-skinned people, I guess, but primarily white people. So it is an anxiety they have because they can see it coming. They think it's inevitable. Whether they aspire to it or not, you know, I think it depends on the individual. But I think this is why...
Go on. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say, this is why whenever you're like in an Asian American online space, the topic of hapus is always extremely loaded because it is essentially like a referendum on intermarrying with white people. The question of, are hapus going to be fully accepted into the Asian American community, is, if not a direct, then at the very least an indirect casting of judgment on whether, you know, being with white, like we call it interracial, but it's almost always white. Like, how does that affect your Asianness? So I think this is a lot of people thinking about their own future and how they're going to deal with it. And I think that fuels a lot of that obsession. As you said, like some of these people are like unmistakably black. This is not a problem that they themselves really have to deal with. But I think they're thinking, my kids, my future generation, or our community in general will eventually have to deal with this more.
I think maybe both of us might be right. The more I think about it, I think it's something they psychologically relate to, because they're psychologically always trying to pass, like, you know, am I pass, I mean, like, is what I'm saying or my taste or all my things betraying that my taste, my culturation, my refinement are up to par with the white person? You know, like, am I passing when I'm eating at this dinner table, or do I look like, you know, I don't know which fork goes with what? Am I passing when it's time to talk intellectually? Am I passing? You know, like, I think that, but also I think for their kids, they think it's going to be literal. And that's demographic destiny. I think they might think it's demographic destiny because a lot of them literally have white partners, you know, as well. So
yeah, I think it's a perfect time to talk about the recent HuffPo piece.
Oh, yeah, you're right. I mean, without even meaning to, I think it was a perfect dovetail.
Yeah. So this piece is written by a black woman who has a white husband, and she's talking about how I think her kid is mostly white passing, right? I've seen pictures. She puts pictures of it in her article. White.
It's also a weird article in that kids change a lot, you know, within that time. Like, she seems paranoid about it way too early. Like, that kid can change skin tones like in a couple of years, you know? So she's so anxious about it already. I found that weird.
Yeah, and what was immediately just recognizable was how this has been written by an Asian American at least like 20 times before. I probably have it in my spreadsheet where I keep track of all this. But all the familiar, you know, it was greatest hits. You have the, you know, I didn't really fit in with my own group. Like, you got the kind of skirting of the question, well, if you were so invested in having like a black or Asian baby, why not have a black or Asian partner? And that's just kind of, you know, well, you know, I fell in love with this white person, and that smoothed over this fixation, this insecurity about your very distinctive ethnic feature. For the writer here, it's her hair. For the Asian person, it would probably be the eyes. And it was just so It was just like you just did, you know, control F and just switch black and Asian and a few little details like hair and eyes. It would have been an Asian American article that you would see on, you know, Asian Voices HuffPo, you know, last year or a couple of years ago. So this is like a certain genre. Yeah, I mean,
okay, that's my question. Is it just a matter of this is a genre and they're picking up the genre and learning the tropes? Or is this like a real thing? Because I think the part of it that makes me think that it might be just a real thing. And I feel like Trevor's kind of hinting at that this is actually their real thoughts, right? There's a really good Ali Wong joke in one of her stand-up specials, I think the first one, where she's married to another Asian American. And they're all like mixed up. Like she's half Vietnamese, half Chinese. I think her husband's like Filipino and Japanese.
Yeah.
And, yeah. And so at their house, they have like a Chinese calligraphy piece hanging on the wall. And she jokes like her and her husband are like, you know, we're like, just like white people pretending we're Asian. Meaning that there's no underlying quote authenticity. Which is like that's another buzzword, right, Chris? Like you see all the time, like is this cultural authenticity? And I've noticed that in the, at least in Black Twitter, the small segment of it that I do see, usually through like your retweets and stuff like that, or someone that I follow, that authenticity comes up a lot too, as to whether someone actually, you know, grew up in a Black community or did they grow up mostly with white people? And I wonder, you know, because a lot of times that kind of article or this obsession with whether they pass or whether they fit in, whether they can assimilate, I almost wonder, is it actually just the desire to be white? Is that what it is? Or is it the sort of like inner anxiety to really, there's no real authentic Asian in here. Like everyone thinks I'm actually Asian, but if you look inside of me, there's like no, I didn't grow up around Asian people. I don't know anything about Asian people, but you all expect, you know, does that make sense?
I know what you mean. You know, something interesting is I think very, very few people actually want to be white. And not out of any type of racial pride, so to speak, but there's this guy, he's a psychologist. I was gonna say psychology guy, like that's a psychologist. I don't know why I was gonna say that, but yeah, this psychologist his name is William Swan Jr. And he has a really interesting book. It's called like The Self Trap. I think he re-released it under a different name as well. I think that might be the original name. I don't know why he gave the book a second title, but it's a very interesting book in that he talks about why change is so hard. And one of the things he says is that people don't really, they think they want to change, but people are very resistant to changing their identity. Like their identity is very, very much a part of them, even if they think they hate themselves. It's very tough to really, and there's the story in it of a guy who wanted a deeper voice because he hated his voice. So he goes to this voice coach. Guy says, I can train you to have a deeper voice. It's not hard. And he does all these lessons. He gets pretty good at it. And then the vocal coach sees him in the street a couple of months later. And he's talking in his old voice. And the guy's like, why are you talking in your old voice? Like, what happened? And he's like, yeah, but, you know, that wasn't me. So, you know, despite all this stuff, when he got the out to have a different voice, And the whole book is just about how psychologically we just have, even if it's attachment to the self-hate, we just get very attached to or comfortable with the idea of who we are, and it's very jarring. And I think that's kind of what's happening with a lot of these people. That's why there's this kind of over-the-top. I mean, in addition to the fact that they literally can't change their race, so there's that. But I think there's also this over-the-top pro-blackness or pro-Asianness that a lot of these people do. And I don't think it's totally fake. Like, I don't think they want to give up being their race, even if they could, most of them. I think you have to be particularly extremely self-hating to really hit that level. I think they want to be what they are, but just accepted by other people. I think it actually scares. I think actually being white would scare them in a strange way.
Well, if they became white, they would kind of have nothing to do because their entire output is always, you know, spinning the same wheels. You know, am I Asian? Am I American? What am I? I think what they want.
There's a comfort in that. That becomes your identity.
Yeah, I think what they want is for people to continue to be fascinated by that. They feel entitled for that to be the question that that leads the community's narrative, which is why they always get so huffy and puffy about gatekeeping when people say, "Oh, that's not very black" or "that's not very Asian." That really riles them up because they want. Their I think definition of like kind of what everyone should aspire to be is them. They're in their own confused state. That's what everyone should be pondering. That should be their community's great philosophical questions.
I'm wondering though if that's a cover up, you know, because with the Asian folks who do this, like they're usually, it's like I said, like Ali Wong, they're people who are. And she's funny because she's just coming out and saying what it is. But I think a lot of times it's a cover up to where they pretend like they understand the Asian cultures from which they're at least one generation removed. They don't really have any connection to it. They can't speak the language, or if they do, very stilted. They don't understand the culture and never really had an interest in the first place. But they realize that a lot of white attention is paid to them, let's say in publishing or media or whatever, and they're expected to, or they're perceived to have an quote inner authentic Asianness that they're encouraged to reveal. And I feel like they're self-conscious about the fact that it's really not, there's not much to it, if that makes sense. Like
I think also, and I think this is what Chris was kind of getting at, is it becomes their identity. I mean, just in general, I mean, there's people who grew up in bad, dysfunctional families who keep saying they want something better, but they keep picking partners who, you know, recreate that same kind of dysfunction. And when you ask them why, it's because it's comfortable to them. Like, it's what they know. Even if it's makes them miserable, it's a misery that they're comfortable with. And I think that's kind of ties in here, as in when Chris said they wouldn't know who to be otherwise, like without this story, you know, because it's become a substitute for personality for them. Like, you know, it's the closest thing that to them makes them interesting. And without it, like, what would they be? In a way, it's their entry into being interesting to white people. Like, they can't be a more interesting white person than a white person. They have no training in it. They have no whatever. They'll just be an extra weird white person. But being a assimilated non-white person, I think, makes them more interesting. Then you could talk about code switching and being trapped between two worlds and being not blank enough for the blank kids but not white enough for the white kids. It's a story that, you know, they probably know how to get sex from it. They probably know how to get attention from it. They probably know how to sell stories off of it. It's their story. It's hard to change your story. That people fall in love with their own story.
Yeah, and that confusion itself becomes the new authentic identity. And it's not a given that confusion should matter at all. I mean, going back to the Meghan Markle thing, and I'm not just doing this because I tried to watch the whole thing. I couldn't take it. I watched half of it, but there's a sunk cost to it, so I do want to talk about it a bit. But I think it reflects this upper class.
You talking about the Oprah Winfrey?
Yeah. Oh, God, it was god-awful. Okay. For 10 minutes, they go back and forth talking about, did Kate make you cry or did you make Kate cry? And just considering all that's happening in, like, the UK right now, you know, with COVID and other things, it was just like, really? Why are you talking about this? But the whole reason why I find this to be very interesting is, like, this preoccupation with how will my white in-laws who are probably like some class above me, even if like I make more money by virtue of them being white, they will have something over me. How do I fit in here? What will my, you know, half white baby be like? This is to them just a given concern. Like, well, duh, this defines our community's identity and conundrum and everything. But if you were, say, a black person, you have no interest in, like, you know, a white partner. If you're Asian, you have no interest in a white partner. Why would you care about that? It's not really a question that will come to your mind. But these people want this to be at the center of their, like, community narrative, because for them, it's at the center. So that's why I find this very interesting, and why the type of minorities who are so invested in this, in a way that they would not be invested with, like, say, Kate Middleton.
I think what you said about it being the new authenticity is interesting as well. They want it to be the new representative struggle of the race. Is that?
Yeah, because there is this idea, and I agree with that. If you are, like, Asian American or, like, Black American, you are like a different culture than just American or Asian in Asia or African in Africa. It is something different. So, especially with Asian Americans, because we're such a new community, most of us don't have deep roots here, it's still being defined. And I think what really fuels so much of the fight is that it's a fight to define it. Like, is our community basically going to be defined by our preoccupation with how we're going to fit in with, like, our white in-laws? Because that's a thing that is not evenly shared, especially across gender lines, especially across class lines. It doesn't affect everyone equally. So why is it that this keeps being brought up as our main, like, thing that we have to always pay attention to?
Here's something interesting that you might find. I mean, I only just found this out. You might already know this, but I just found out recently there's an official term for that. It's called third culture kid.
Oh, yeah. I've heard that before.
There's a whole body of literature and academic stuff, you know, about it. And for people at home who don't know what it is, third culture kids or third culture individuals are people who were raised in a culture other than their parents or the culture of their country of nationality, and also live in a different environment during a significant part of their child development years. It might not be a perfect example, because I think you have to grow up maybe overseas as well. But I do feel like being the child of immigrants kind of has that aspect to it. But it's interesting that these people aren't the children of immigrants. A lot of times they're on the black side, like black Americans, people who've been here for hundreds of years, and it's kind of weird to see them having these third culture issues going on. It's very bizarre, where they're actually American with generations in America and acting like they're a stranger to two lands. It's just very, very surreal, because I think at that point it's almost has to be a choice, you know what I mean? Like, you just don't want to be part of your parents' culture that bad.
Yeah, and that really shakes up a lot of Asian Americans thinking, because a lot of us, we think our problem is we don't have a deeply rooted culture, and B, even if you can trace yourself back to, you know, like the Chinatown railroad workers, it's not a desirable, cool culture. And you can definitely say that Black Americans have very deep roots. Black culture, especially nowadays, you know, it's like every corporation is trying to, like, profit off of black culture. It's so popular. Yet to see the same thing happen, it's both kind of encouraging in that, okay, we're not alone, but it's also discouraging to be like, man, how can you resist this if even like black Americans are behaving like us? Which makes me
think, like, Asians are moving away from it, though.
Yeah, it could be kind of like an equilibrium thing.
I feel like the backlash against this is, yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said, Teen. You said you think what?
I think that there's been a lot of backlash lately against, especially in the Trump era, that a lot of Asian people sort of like, I mean, I think it was, okay, so I think it was kind of taboo for people to say stuff like Joella Club was garbage, because it was just, you know, all the men were written out. It centered around just women, only women's stories, and of course all the romantic partners were white, if I recall. And so it was taboo, I think, for because this was such a big seminal thing, like, oh my god, we're on the big screen, right? And so everyone universally was pressured to love this thing, and they taught the book in school, for god's sake. And so that was our sort of like one big marquee entrant into mainstream American culture at that time was Joyla Club. And it carried the sort of pattern that people over time more and more were just starting to question, like, how come, you know, it's always this the Asian woman of is in dealing with assimilation into whiteness, and then the white partner thing is the other, it's the East Meets West story, and then the guy's basically not irrelevant. There at all. Yeah, irrelevant. And it was, I mean, Frank Chin had started pushing back, but I think in the way back, but he was considered a complete, you know, kook, a complete, you know, marginal figure. But over time, I feel like the what was a taboo thing, which was just to think that there was something wrong with this, started to become socialized, especially on social media. And now I'm starting to see that there's even, I think, a real awareness in the mainstream, like even in Asian American Hollywood, this desire to make the Asian guy, to sexualize the Asian guy, and to make sure that he gets Chad roles, and, you know, we want to break Asian stereotypes. And there are Asian Chads in a lot of stories now, right?
And yeah, isn't it interesting? Yeah,
it is. Yeah, it is, and it's totally conscious, is my point. Like, I think like there is a to a degree an awareness now that this has gone too far with Asian people, and Asian people are now kind of expecting a different thing to happen, and so they chatify the Asian guy or whatever. But with on the black side of things, I feel like the number one is I've never noticed such an obsession with media representation as until recently, and then a lot of, like you said, a lot of obsession about assimilation and passability, and specifically the ways that black people can fit into white society, but specifically like black women and their compatibility with white men. And I'm just like, that's what Asians are supposed to be doing. Like, how did this happen? That's my point, is like, there does seem to be a change, right? Chris,
I think it points to, there are like two ways, I'm sure there are like shades in between, but I would say like two polar extremes a minority can exist. You can either be of the feminized assimilation mindset. And I only say feminized, not as like a value judgment, but just kind of like, to what stereotypical gender roles does this favor? And I think there's like feminized assimilation versus like, say, masculine, like, let's say rebellion. And it favors different things, because if you are of like the assimilation mode, everything's all about the preoccupation with fitting in. It's like sad, reflective, and it just doesn't really work well for guys. And conversely, if you are of like the masculine, like rebellion side, it doesn't really work well for women. And I think with Asian Americans, that's why like Asian guys always want to shake things up, because, you know, at best, well, even the Asian Chad is still kind of cringe in a lot of ways, because he's going to go up on stage, take his shirt off, be like, love me, love me. Like, nobody respects guys who really do that. I mean, in our status quo society, and that's supposed to be the solution. And on the flip side, I think a lot of black women have problems with just like with black culture, the way it's been, because it has been portrayed as very aggressive and all that, which can kind of work well for the guys in some ways, because people do admire like women fighters, but not in the way that you would admire like male fighters. And I'm not talking about like literal fighters, but just the way of just aggressively, you know, burning shit down or whatever. So I think that's why you're seeing the switch. You're seeing like a counterbalancing, because it may have gone too far in one end, and the other side are feeling left out, and they're like, okay, let's try going a different way. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does make sense. It's on the black side, I'll say this. This is what I think, right? And what you said about nobody respects that, when, you know, like these Asian chats kind of try to overcompensate, you know, I feel like we have our own examples of that. We're trying so hard to put the blurred in there and like, look, black people can be smart too. And, you know, the person will be like, have glasses on and be like a total nerd girl, and she'll be like have a big textbook in tow, and I'm like, that's too much. But I think there was an idea, and I could be wrong, but I think there's a tendency to kind of ennoble like the past generations of Black entertainment and say, oh, they weren't trying for white acceptance. But I think maybe, and this might be an uncomfortable thing to ponder, but it's possible, maybe we just didn't think we had any chance of getting it. So it was kind of easy to be like, you know, it's kind of like when a guy is talking about a hot girl is out of his league, and, you know, he can say, oh, she's ugly anyway. But he might just be saying that because he don't think he has a chance anyway. But then,
you know, sour grapes, yeah.
Yeah, but then when the guy finds out he does have a chance, he might suddenly turn to maybe a total simp. And you're like, wait, what happened to all that other stuff? You know, it's like, oh, that's when I thought I didn't have a chance. There's a part of me that really believes that we really didn't want the representation. I really remember those things. I remember when anything Black had too much mainstream acceptance, like say in rap or something, it started becoming a sign it was corny, or there was a type of, maybe part of us being Gen X, and Gen X was about rebelling and not being mainstream in general. That was like the peak value of Gen X-ness. But for whatever reason, I feel like there was a sincere desire to not assimilate, to not whatever. And I feel like these people now have the opportunity. There's an actual hunger for tokens. There's a hunger for Black entertainment that white people can enjoy, or, you know, whatever. And part of me wonders if that market, if that money, if that carrot was dangling on a stick in front of my generation, how many of us would have stuck to our principles, and how many would have rationalized it away? I mean, there was always stuff that was ostensibly Black, but really made for white audiences. And a lot of times we'll get kind of rejected by the people as being, oh, this is corny, or this is like some Uncle Tom stuff. But now they've mastered a way of giving it a veneer of pro-Blackness or wokeness, you know what I mean? That wasn't there before. I mean, I don't really have a conclusion here. I'm just kind of thinking out loud. I'm just wondering how much of it is a sticking to principles versus, I mean, I think now we stick to the principles because we grew up with them. But say we were at these people are young, in their 20s or whatever, you know, and this is more money than they ever thought. And they already went to like Ivy League schools and are already kind of comfortable with these people in these rooms. You know, they've gone to Harvard and Yale and the places that these writers' rooms populate themselves with. So, you know, I guess I'm trying to show them a little bit of grace. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a definite thing to ponder. Maybe the shift happened because people saw that there could be like a hip hop billionaire. And whereas before it was everything was, you had to, you know, be against the system and everything, because there was like the idea of that was so ludicrous. But now, you know, you can.
And also, if you got there, you had to be so clearly compromised. Like to get to that level, you had to be Hammer with the genie pants and the S girls. And a lot of people didn't want to do that. But if you could be a billionaire, looking and talking like Jay-Z or Dre, it's like, okay, I really look and talk like that now. It's not even that big a, you know, I can at least have the plausibility of not selling out.
Yeah, but I mean, there's still something qualitatively different about the Netflix type or Hulu type content that we're seeing now that I don't think would have been possible no matter how much money was being paid back then.
Mm.
There's a cultural component to this that's going on. And I'm just seeing that there's, whether it's probably a confluence, I think, of the shifting culture, but also a feedback loop of media reflecting that culture back to people. But there's definitely a loop here where I feel like at least what I read from like Black opinion writers and media commentators and stuff like that is a real embrace of this stuff. Whereas I feel like Asian people either we're not even talking about it or we're running away from it, because I feel like, at least for me, when I see this stuff, there's a sort of like uncanny valley where I'm like, this is shit Asian people used to talk about.
Yeah, I think the period of Asian fascination, is kind of gone. I think there was, and you can see it in these old movies. If you look at the, like, I was watching a lot of these movies because Turner Classic Movies is having a marathon. There's like Sayonara with Marlon Brando, The Wondrous World of Susie Wong, and all these other types of things that had like a lot of different Asian people in them. A lot of them had the War Bride narrative, but there was also Bridge on River Kwai. There was this musical. I think it was a musical. It was all Asian.
South Pacific?
No, it wasn't that one. This one was something as way less known.
Oh, Flower Drum Song.
Yeah. There was that one. I mean, there seemed to be this kind of thing going on where there was a lot of Asian fascination out there that I think is not really there now. Like for example, look at Crazy Rich Asians. You would think that would cause some kind of explosion. It really didn't. It's interesting. For whatever reason, now I think there is that. Like for example, I'm old enough to remember when Joy Luck Club came out, and it wasn't something that only Asian Americans were interested in. Like everybody watched Joy Luck Club. It was just considered like you're getting a piece of something if you watch this, and it was covered everywhere. A lot of people I knew who were not Asian all went to see it. I was too young, so it wasn't the kind of movie I wanted to see. But, you know, like people's parents, my parents, like it was just kind of cool. And I think in this Black Lives Matter era, like there's this kind of thing where this is what white liberals are doing. It's cool to consume Black culture. And I think you guys have mentioned in the past something that I think explains a lot of it when we were talking about how an Asian woman isn't a good racism shield anymore, like they used to be for a white guy, because I guess maybe the model minority thing has picked up too much, or maybe it's become too well known that you can date an Asian person and still be racist or whatever. I feel like maybe something similar has happened to Asian media, where it's like white people feel like, okay, this is... China's a powerhouse. Maybe Japan had this moment, you know, booming. Like, they're not really otherized enough anymore.
You mean like they will not get any like social points for saying they like consume this thing or that? That's Asian.
Yeah.
I think they overdid it. I think it's two things. One, they overdid it and it became a cliche. And yeah, they're now with, you know, and Chris, we talked about this, like a Bret Easton Ellis could Aaron Sorkin could spot this in Social Network, like the white Jewish guy with the Asian girlfriend on campus, that's not woke. That's just the thing that happens.
Too many people just have like personal experience with it that there's like no fooling anyone anymore, no matter what.
And then there's the yellow fetish thing. The Asian fetish thing was kind of always there, and it got, there's just too much of it, and it became a thing, you know. And then you had Asian girls with white boyfriends.
I started realizing too often too that it's more Mark Zuckerberg than Marlon Brando, you know, like,
yeah.
like before you could pretend it was like the white guy was Marlon Brando or William Holden. And now it's more like Mark Zuckerberg, and that's not, you know, as sexy, you know?
They would run into each other.
No white guy,
right?
Wants to be like Mark Zuckerberg, except for the money.
Yeah, and then there were these, Chris, you remember that one about, I'm a Asian girl, I have a white husband, and God damn it, I keep running into other Asian girls with white husbands.
Oh, yeah, Huffington Post, they crank him out.
Two articles ran into each other. And then I would say ever since we pointed that out to you, Trevor, mm-hmm. It's gone so far as to become, it's gone from cliche to actual liability now, because there was an article in the New York Times coverage about how Elaine Chao, who's the wife of Mitch McConnell, has a conflict of interest because she has too many ties to China. So I think now that Asians, I think there was a period, there's a point of just over, I think we outlived our usefulness in that regards, and people lost interest. And then this, here's another inversion. I feel like America largely, at least, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but at least on the surface, it seems that there's a real turn away from trying to vilify Black people. And there's a more of a sort of reconciliation is the right term, but
the appearance of reconciliation.
Thing, you know, like Black Lives Matter is like hanging off every corporate banner out there. Whereas Asians are openly being vilified now. Right?
Go on. I thought you were done. Go on.
No, but I'm just saying that has been a major change. Well,
I think this is part of it, right? I think Asians are just too successful now, and you kind of see it in how they're actively working against their admission in schools now. And Chris tweeted something that was interesting about they're not even pretending it's about the rich ones anymore. They're even saying stuff about the ones who aren't rich, you know, about just saying, hey, we don't want you guys in here. In that, I think they're too scared, I think, to mascot Asian American people, because now they're looking at them as a real threat to white hegemony in a way, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That's like the China stuff, how scared they are of China. There was a hint of it in the 80s with Japan. You start seeing entertainment like the movie Gung Ho and all this stuff about, but then the Japan thing kind of went away. The Japan boom went away, but Japan was tied to capitalism. So in a way that their boom was and bust were still kind of tied to America's, but China just
subsumed. Yeah.
It's like a sibling rivalry.
Yeah. Whereas China just seems like this kind of thing that doesn't play by the same rules and maybe can overtake America. And the China stuff, I've never seen anything like it over here. If you're someone who's into like race science, then you're hung up on the IQ thing. If you're someone who's like just a white liberal who wants their kid to go to Harvard and Yale, then you're upset with Asian people because of that, because they're I feel like there's a lot of united front about that. And it's a double-edged sword. Like, I think it allows you, you're allowed, I think, they don't want to do it. Like, at the time of the Suzy Wong stuff and all that stuff, I think Asians were still seen as third world and quaint enough that you could still kind of mascot them. You could still kind of view them in this kind of third world way that you're being benevolent. Now it's like this person is a legitimate threat. It's not quite the same. But the flip side is that also gives you license, I think, to bully them openly as well. Like, so I think the feeling of having to reconcile or to mascot has kind of subsided because it's too dangerous to mascot anymore. And it's too dangerous to help. But also, thanks to that model minority thing and the whole kind of lie of honorary white thing, you can kind of, because I saw this happening when that Shane Gillis, a lot of people, you know, a lot of those like racist online people kept trying to use social justice language to defend like their racism, and like, it's okay because I'm not punching down. And they start putting stats, this was really happening in threads, where these racist people, like these kind of Legion of Skanks type guys who are, you know, stand-up comedy racist trolls, were putting all these bar graphs and charts about Asian progress. This was actually happening in replies to people calling them out for being racist, and they're trying to do like what they thought was social justice warrior 12th dimensional chess, where it's like, you guys say punching down is bad, well look at this stuff about Asians, I'm a poor white, it's okay.
Right.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of the problem. Black people, I don't think, really register as a threat to them. I think at the end of the day, whether it's even Issa Rae coming from Yale or somebody coming from Harvard, I think they still kind of think of them as dumb, and they're at their benevolence. I don't think they really see these people as a threat. I think the threat that we are is a sexual threat in terms of genetic annihilation, but only the men. That's mm-hmm. that's
yeah, right, right.
Yeah, we're not an intellectual threat. We're not a socioeconomic threat. So we're fun to mascot. We're fun to do the reconciliation with. But if you notice, everything they put this stuff in, there's no real place for straight black men, really. Bridgerton was a surprise in that regard, I think. And I think that's what kept it from really being Tumblr-able, like as far as gifts. But for the most part, I feel like the men are always gay all the time. There's this new show called Generation they're showing. And as soon as I saw it, I said, that black guy's going to be queer. And sure enough, he was queer. All the Netflix shows too, the black guy is like always gay.
Yeah, there definitely is the analog there. Like, Chris, you know that you sent that tweet where I think like some food writer, Asian woman, like just said like Asian male chefs are gentrifying.
Oh yeah,
Chinatown or something like.
I think she's some activist in New York City. Yeah, okay. But she singled out Asian male chefs for gentrifying Chinatowns all over America. And it was like, I can understand if you're accusing Asian chefs, but why male chefs? Is it okay if a woman does it? And it's a very gendered way of looking at things. And I think you see that pop up. I did that in response because like Trevor had tweeted something about who had sold what channel. I forget what that was about.
Oh yeah it was about Jay-Z selling Tidal, and then people were like, oh, black men always sell everything, you know, black, you know, they always sell out their companies to white people, and it was a Jay-Z, black man, the weakest links. And then I responded with Oprah Winfrey sold OWN to Discovery, you know. And I gave all these examples. I was like, Carol's daughter in Brooklyn, the natural hair thing, sold to L'Oreal. And of course, nobody responded. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, because it's all an excuse. It's not really about
exactly
that. So anyway, Teen, you were saying?
Oh, no. I mean, I was just saying, like, I was just kind of recall, like, why I even thought of this topic in the first place. Because, like, lately, like, when we started doing this pod and Plan A and stuff, like, I think we did focus a lot more on, like, representational issues and just sort of, like, trying to put the nail in the coffin on a lot of that, on these things, or at least untabooing them or whatever. But ever since, with COVID especially, and this sort of like rapid sort of demonization of China and North Korea and sort of like getting back to like Cold War era stuff, you know, like I find myself on Twitter mostly joining other, like, you know, parts of what they call China Twitter or whatever, trying to point out how like the New York, like how the liberal media lies or obfuscates or biases stuff. And I've noticed that like a lot of like someone like Andre or someone like these sometimes like often like older black guys or older black women or like younger black but like Pan-African Marxist types like really will actually like follow me or like my tweets or stuff like that. And there's a real discourse going on now between like China Twitter and like Pan-African Marxists and stuff like this, because they're each focusing on an aspect that is of particular interest to them. But I feel like it's sort of like Asians' time to figure that out. Whereas a lot of like these Marxists were sort of pointing this out earlier. And so now it's like a convergence in that place, but it's like sort of older and more fringe politics. Whereas, you know, with the representational stuff, I'm like, my God, it's, I sometimes feel like the arguments that people are having in on Black Twitter about it, it's just like what was going on with Asians, but it's like 100 times more intense.
I've
never seen anything like weakest link type stuff like just said outright. Like they at least try to hide that stuff. I've never seen that before.